Just a few weeks ago, the governor of Arkansas scheduled 8 executions within a 10-day period. They're supposed to start next week on Monday, April 17th, the day after Easter Sunday. And they've got 2 executions scheduled each day on 4 separate days. And the reason for that is that their drug for the lethal injection is about to expire. So they have exactly 8 doses of midazolam, and they need to use all 8 before the end of April.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, and today we have a special edition. I'm interviewing James Clark from Amnesty International. How are you doing, James?
Good. How are you?
Can you tell us what your title is with Amnesty?
Sure. I'm the senior campaigner for death penalty abolition at Amnesty USA.
Okay. And I understand Amnesty International is coming out with a policy paper. Is that what it is?
Or, no, it's an annual report. We put out a global report each year that documents death sentences and executions around the world.
Really? And do you have to go out there personally and do any of this research?
No, not me. We have a team that coordinates the research based in London. And then, you know, the way that we collect the statistics varies country to country. So most countries around the world are pretty transparent about their use of the death penalty and publish official statistics that are more or less reliable, and we can verify those in a variety of ways. In some countries, we have to dig a little bit deeper. Countries like China, Malaysia, Vietnam, for example, are countries that classify the death penalty as a state secret. Hmm. So we do that through looking through public media reports, sometimes interviewing individuals, families of people, or representatives of people who are on death row.
Wow. All right. So this report, I've looked at the summary of it. It's pretty interesting, the results that came out this year. And I was particularly interested in what's been going on in the U.S. Can we talk about the U.S. and then maybe globally, and then maybe drill down a little deeper into death penalty in general?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. The first thing I want to tell you is, here at Real Crime Profile, we talk about very violent crimes, and we do it from a victim-centric perspective. Laura Richards and I were both criminal behavioral analysts and worked in this field for decades. We came across some pretty bad people. We still come across really bad people. And one of the issues that comes up from time to time is the death penalty. So I think it's particularly relevant to our listeners. Why do we have the death penalty? Is it effective? What are the trends in the United States and around the world? So if we can talk about those things, that would be great today.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. So what are some of the statistics that jump out at you from this global report?
One of the first things about this year's data is that there were 20 executions in the United States. That's low. It's the lowest it's been since 1991.
Really?
And as a result of that, the United States, for the first time since 2006, is not in the top 5 of the biggest executors in the world. Typically, we're right about number 5, following countries like China, Iran, Pakistan, other countries that execute large numbers of people.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think conceptually, the United States likes to think of itself in an entirely different category than those countries that you just mentioned in terms of civilization, in terms of humanity, in terms of being on the cutting edge of human rights, actually going around the world and enforcing human rights. But that's a weird statistic, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And certainly the U.S. likes to claim human rights leadership around the world, and that we really lead the world in protecting human rights. The United States government doesn't acknowledge the death penalty as a violation of human rights, even though international norms are pretty clear about that. Mm. And so, you know, the majority of countries around the world have abolished the death penalty. 2/3 of the countries in the world have abolished it either in law or in practice. And so the United States is a real outlier. And you're right that the countries that use the death penalty at comparable rates to us tend to be looked at in the United States as countries that are human rights abusers.
Mm. And in that vein, has the trend, you said that this is This is the lowest number of executions in the United States since 1991. Mm-hmm. Is that a trend that is actually, that you see moving in that same direction in the future in the United States?
Absolutely. It's a longstanding trend. And really, executions have been steadily decreasing for quite a while. There's a number of reasons for that. You know, it comes down to, in some states, there are legal hurdles that the states just can't get over to get their executions on track. But in a lot of states, it's simply dwindling. Even in states like Texas that continue to lead when it comes to the number of executions, the number is getting smaller, and the number of death sentences that juries are handing down is decreasing every year.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised to see that. I think it was Georgia that had the highest number of mm-hmm. executions in the United States. Why is that?
Georgia's always been a relatively high executor. It's one of the few states that tends to lead the pack from year to year. So it's not too surprising. This year in particular, they had a large jump. I'm not sure, you know, if there was any particular legal cause for that. But it wasn't too unusual given the numbers that Georgia tends to execute each year. But really, you know, I think one thing that is interesting is that Georgia was the highest number, but Georgia and Texas together were responsible for 80% of all the executions in the U.S.
Yeah.
So it really kind of illustrates that the number of states that carry out executions is a small, isolated number. They're outlier states that are engaged in this practice in a way that's very different from the majority of U.S. states.
And we can get into this a little more later, I guess, but are there any particular statistics about those who are executed in those states? Who are the ones that actually get executed?
Yeah. You know, this report doesn't go deep into those statistics, but they're certainly out there. And one of the things that we tend to see year to year is that the people who are executed are people with very low intellectual functioning, borderline intellectual disability, people with severe mental illness, long histories of abuse and drug abuse and sexual abuse. And those types of stories are pretty ubiquitous when it comes to death penalty cases. We see in the Supreme Court opinions that have been coming out in the last few years, they've been reducing the number of people that are eligible for execution. So, you know, a few years ago, the Supreme Court ruled that people with intellectual disability are not eligible for execution, but they left it up to the states to decide who qualifies as intellectually disabled. Mm. So a lot of what we're seeing are those borderline cases where, you know, of course, intellectual disability is a spectrum and there is no objective answer. So a lot of borderline cases with subjective opinions are the folks who end up being executed in the end.
And I don't imagine there's a high number of wealthy people on that list.
No, definitely not.
So, I mean, is it statistically very poor people?
Yes, absolutely. And almost universally people who require state assistance for their defense. They're taking public defense because they're indigent defendants who can't afford a capital defense attorney.
And that's something that, you know, as a former prosecutor myself and somebody who's been a career law enforcement officer, it bothers me that is still something that's present in our society. We're supposed to be an advanced society, yet the poor seem to be the ones that are getting the brunt of this kind of punishment.
Yeah, it's a pretty stark difference when you look at who's on death row and you know, the range of people who are committing crimes all around the country, and then who exactly is being targeted for the punishment that in theory is supposed to be reserved for the worst of the worst. Mm-hmm. Right. But I mean, you can certainly see the severity of the crime or the circumstances of the crime are not the primary determining factors of who is sentenced to death. I mean, those factors are things more like geography, where you happen to live. The race of your victim is one of the primary determining factors. Certainly wealth and socioeconomic status, and then things like intellectual disability and history of abuse. Those are the determining factors.
And what about the race of the offender?
Race of the offender does play a factor. The research on that is a little bit more mixed, and so there's less clear of a sort of causal line between the race of the offender and the sentence. But the race of the victim has been shown in studies all around the country and in several states, repeated studies. The race of the victim, when a victim is white, tends to significantly increase the likelihood that a person will be sentenced to death.
And does that apply across the board with respect to whether or not the offender was the same race?
So it varies. A non-white offender convicted of murdering a white victim is at the greatest likelihood of receiving a death sentence. Mm-hmm. And in some places it varies. So I know in California, African-Americans convicted of killing white defendants are more likely than Latinos convicted of killing white defendants, and they're in turn more likely than white defendants. Hmm.
And has that trend changed at all over the time that Amnesty has been collecting this data?
No, those studies have been pretty consistent across the board for, you know, probably since the 80s.
And so just so our listeners know, the only crimes that the death penalty is applicable for is for murder, right?
Right, that's right. In the United States, the only death crime that is death penalty eligible is murder with special circumstances. So states have to actually, every state has a little bit of a different scheme, but states have to identify certain factors that make a particular murder more heinous. And so those factors can include things like multiple victims or the presence of torture or other things that might make a crime more heinous than a typical murder.
And can we talk a little bit about, for the benefit of our listeners, what is the actual reason for the death penalty, that at least in the United States?
That's a really good question, and it definitely varies on who you ask and what you're trying to get at. You know, I think a lot of prosecutors will tell you that the reason is deterrence. They might also say that the reason is justice for victims. I think that's a really common argument that I hear a lot. And a lot of people have a really strong sense of proportional punishment and just the strong ideological feeling that when you kill someone, you ought to die. That's certainly a line of thinking that I hear a lot. I tend to think one of the big reasons is that it's just been around for a long, long time. And, you know, we've more or less always had it. And if you have confidence that your justice system, you know, as we said, the U.S. likes to think of itself as a human rights leader. So if you have a lot of confidence that your justice system is great and values human rights and it happens to employ the death penalty, then I think for a lot of people that's enough to think it's probably a good idea.
Well, let's talk about those things. The first one was deterrence.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any data on whether or not it actually deters people from the kinds of crimes that actually end up in a conviction and sentencing to death?
Yeah, there is data on that, and there is no deterrent value to the death penalty.
So what does the data say?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to approach it. It's a difficult research question. So I should, to be perfectly fair, there's data that goes both ways, and there are research studies published that show either result, either show a deterrent effect or no deterrent effect. There was a trend a few years ago to put out a handful of studies came out using a particular methodology that showed that there was a deterrent effect. And after that kind of spate of studies a few years ago, the American Research Association came out and said that that methodology was fundamentally flawed. So they have said that there is no methodologically valid study that shows a deterrent effect of the death penalty.
So you're saying that although there are studies that say that there is a deterrent effect to the death penalty, that those studies have actually been invalidated?
Discredited, yes. Yeah.
So that's deterrent effect. What about justice? Does it really provide justice?
Well, that's the question. And, you know, certainly you can't quantify justice. And you mentioned that you you and the show approach crime from a victim-centric perspective, and so certainly the feelings of victims is one measure by which justice might be measured. And I think it's important to say that victims' family members and survivors of murder victims are, of course, diverse, and they think lots of different things, and right. There's no unanimity. I've worked with a lot of victims' family members who've been really re-traumatized by the death penalty. And the death penalty keeps them in the courtroom. It keeps them attending hearings and appeals for in some cases, decades, whereas a life sentence doesn't tend to do that. Mm. And I've worked with many victims' family members who had been given this promise from a prosecutor that we're going to get there. We're going to execute this guy. And either that promise was never fulfilled, because in many cases an execution won't happen and prosecutors simply can't promise that it will. But then sometimes the person does get executed, and that sense of justice doesn't come the way that they thought that it might. And, you know, again, I've got to say, I've worked with victims' family members in advocating against the death penalty. So obviously there are many others who have different feelings about it.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I know personally, and obviously this is just my personal opinion, that to me, the cold, calculating taking of another person's life is just not something that a government should do. I do understand victims and why they might want retribution, but whether a retribution equals justice is a big question in my mind. Is it really going to make them feel better? Do we want the raw emotions of victims to be the driving force behind something as fundamental as taking the life of another person?
Yeah, that's a good question and an important perspective. And, you know, Amnesty International, we oppose the death penalty because it's a human rights violation. And so I think from that perspective, fundamentally depriving anyone of their basic human rights is never justice.
Well, and how can you do math behind that? How do you get to that conclusion that the death penalty is a human rights violation?
Well, the right to life is the paramount human right. I think, you know, all other human rights stem from the right to simply exist.
It is the first one noted in our Constitution.
Right. And in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. So I think like you said earlier, we're talking about the state, about a government, and about a government process that's going to decide whether you have the right to continue to exist. And I think when you put it in those terms and you think about, you know, this is the government that we don't trust to fill our potholes. Is that really the job that you want the government to be in? Do you think the government has the authority and the legitimate right to decide who can exist and who can't, and whose human rights can be protected and whose won't be?
Well, I think for me, one of the fundamental problems is that the government changes on a whim. There are longstanding pendulum swings just in all sorts of different areas of the law. And we've seen some dramatic changes and unchanges happen over time. And I think also over time, we get a little more educated, I think, in terms of what is actually right and just and so forth. So I'm encouraged by the trend that you talk about. But, I fundamentally want to deal with the issue, because I think there's a lot of people that firmly believe that it is justified, it is right, it is something we should do.
Yeah, you know, and I think we can kind of go around in circles about that, because there's only so much you can say to someone or to yourself even that are going to change your sort of fundamental views about justice and right and wrong. And, you know, I think, like I said, a lot of people have a firmly held belief that when you take a life, you deserve to die. And I'm not sure that I know how to dissuade someone of that attitude. But I think at that point, it's really helpful to say, well, how does this work? Are we okay? If you take that premise, are we deciding the right people who deserve to die? Are we Are we sure that we got it right every time, you know?
Sure. And that brings up, I think, another fundamental issue with the death penalty, and that's wrongful convictions.
Right.
Now, of the people exonerated through the Innocence Project, how many of them were on death row?
So I think the number of death row exonerees right now is 162. You know, it goes up every couple of months. So it might be a little bit higher than that by now, but it's definitely above 160. And those are people who had been sentenced to death and then were later exonerated. And it really shows that you can never be perfect. No human system is going to be infallible.
Yeah. If I'm not mistaken, I think it was the governor of Texas or the head of the Department of Corrections. I can't remember who said that he estimated 10% of the people in prisons in Texas are actually wrongfully convicted. Mm. 10%.
I hadn't heard that, but it doesn't surprise me.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if you extrapolate that, that's a lot of people.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I'm sure Texas isn't the only one.
No. And the Equal Justice Initiative is an organization in Alabama. They estimated that for every 9 executions, there's 1 exoneration.
Wow. And in other words, that 9 executions that already happened?
Right, right. For 9 executions that have occurred, we've caught 1 person who was not guilty of the crime and exonerated that person. Yeah. So we certainly don't
10%.
Know. Yeah, yeah. And we don't know the numbers that we missed, right? The number of people that may have been executed. There are a handful of cases. Cameron Todd Willingham in Texas is one of the most famous of cases where the evidence is just really overwhelming that the person was innocent and was executed.
Can you tell us about that case briefly?
Yeah, sure. Cameron Todd Willingham was executed in 2004. He was convicted of an arson that killed his children. That was, I believe the case was in the 90s. I don't remember exactly when the fire happened and the conviction. But his conviction was based primarily on forensic science, on arson scientists who were testifying to junk science.
Yeah, I mean, it was supposedly based on science.
Right,
but
exactly.
But in fact...
Exactly. And modern investigative techniques have come through and shown that all of the supposedly scientific evidence that was presented to the jury was completely false. We simply didn't understand the science of fires at the time. And it was combined with some really absurd interpretive evidence. You know, he had a Megadeth poster on his wall, and an expert testified to the jury that that was a sign that he was a Satanist. And then his reactions at watching his children burn to death were scrutinized and judged and determined to be inconsistent with an actual father. So, you know, all of that happened. A modern report was given to the governor just prior to his execution, but... You know, not much time prior, and in the end, he was executed anyway.
Hmm. Well, I just the fact that that could happen one time is enough to make it, because it is permanent.
Yeah,
it is permanent,
yeah.
And it's something you can't undo. It just doesn't seem right to be doing things that could be wrong and still take somebody else's life.
Right, and to just have that sense that. This confidence in our justice system that we can make such an irreversible judgment.
Yeah. So what about the cost of the death penalty versus, say, life imprisonment?
Yeah, good question. You know, most people, I think, intuitively assume that the death penalty is cheaper. The reality is that's just not true. The death penalty costs more money really at every single stage of the justice process. So if you think about, you know, the moment the police arrest an alleged murderer and that person is charged. If they're charged with a death eligible crime or with a capital charge, then everything kind of ramps up and you've got a different set of prosecutors. You've got a team of the best prosecutors and you've got a team of the best defense attorneys. You're given death eligible defense attorneys. In most states you're given more than one. And so obviously that costs a lot more money. The trial has this extra phase at the end because you can't just try someone and then sentence them to death, you have to have a sentencing phase to decide if death is the appropriate punishment.
Right. So they really do another look at all the facts, don't they?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that actually can be more extensive because it's required that you look at the entire life of the defendant. And so you have investigators that go interview someone's parents and their teachers and their psychologists and their counselors who likely counseled them through their history of childhood abuse, right? You investigate all of those things. And then that's just the sentencing phase. Then if someone's sentenced to death, they start the appeals process. That, you know, here in California, the appeals process will probably take 25 years. Most people die of natural causes in California on death row before they can be executed. Mm. So, you know, it varies state to state, but everywhere you go, there's going to be an extremely lengthy and extremely costly appeals process.
Right. And some people will argue, though, that the fact that there have been exonerations, the fact that we give people this appeal process and people win the appeals at times, that proves that the system works.
Yeah, I hear that every now and then. To me, it's pretty clear that the system makes mistakes, and we do have some safety nets that are there to catch those mistakes, and sometimes we catch them, sometimes we don't. I think it's silly to assume that because we caught some, we caught them all. The undeniable fact is that we know that we make mistakes. So how can we have any system that's completely irreversible?
Right. You know? Well, and you said just a minute ago, though, that in death penalty cases, that the defense usually has great attorneys, more expensive defense attorneys. Is that always the case?
No. And it's again, it varies state by state. So I've spent a long time working on the death penalty here in California. So in California, we have a system of qualifying death penalty eligible defense attorneys that does guarantee that they're going to be at least qualified on paper to defend you in a capital trial. It doesn't guarantee they're going to be great. In other states, the system can really vary wildly. In some states, you know, there's a question of whether any competent attorneys are appointed to defense or to death row inmates at all. I actually got started doing death penalty work in Georgia. And the Southern Center for Human Rights is an organization in Georgia that's done incredible work on behalf of death row inmates and people accused of death eligible crimes who've not been given any competent attorney or even any attorney at all. There was a case of a guy, whose name I can't remember, but he was severely mentally ill and he sat in jail for 3 years waiting for his attorney to be appointed to him.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, I have to say that there are really unfortunate circumstances. Not at all that I believe that, you know, being poor or having a rough childhood or growing up really bad justifies somebody's behavior.
Right.
But when somebody is at a disadvantage like that and has nobody to fight for them, the system can really slog on very slowly, and I don't know that justice is actually served there. But on the other hand, does life in prison actually act as a deterrent then?
I mean, I think it's pretty debatable whether any of our punitive justice system acts as a deterrent. I think, you know, the concept of deterrence kind of assumes that a person committing a crime is a rational actor, that they're someone who is thinking about the consequences of their actions and deciding whether the consequences are worth whatever it is they're going to do. It doesn't really take into account desperation. It certainly doesn't take into account mental illness or any of the other, I think, more realistic factors that motivate violent crime.
Well, of course, there's also the issue that many people who commit violent crimes are serial offenders, and they will not stop until they get caught. So whether it's death penalty or life in prison or 2 days in prison, it's not really anything they consider.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's fair. There's certainly those cases of people that are that we just have to protect ourselves from. And that, I think, is what life in prison is for. Not so much to deter, but to keep us safe from people right. who are just too violent to live in our society. Absolutely.
All right, so we've talked a bit about the U.S. What about globally? How does the world fare these days in terms of the death penalty?
Yeah, good question. The majority of the world has abolished the death penalty for all crimes. Over 100 countries have completely abolished it. And 141 countries have abolished the death penalty either in law or in practice, meaning they've not used the death penalty in a decade or more. So that's more than two-thirds of the countries in the world. There are, of course, several countries that continue to use the death penalty excessively. The most is China. China, we can't get firm numbers on the use of the death penalty in China because it's a classified state secret. But we estimate that thousands of executions happen each year, probably more than the rest of the world combined in China.
And is that at all relative, let's say, to the U.S. numbers based on population?
No, not at all. The United States executed 20 people last year. China executed upwards of 1,000. You know, the numbers are not proportional at all.
Okay. And what other countries are the biggest violators?
So
let me say it a different way. So what other countries are the biggest users of the death penalty?
So last year, the top five were China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, and Pakistan. Typically, the U.S. is in the top five. Last year was the first year since 06 that we were not. We were ranked number seven this year.
Hmm. And in those countries, do we have any idea what the death penalty was for? Like here, it can only be used for special circumstances murders, right? Enhanced homicides.
Right.
What about in those countries?
It's a much broader spectrum of crimes. So in many cases, drug crimes are punishable by death in many countries around the world.
I remember landing in the Philippines, and when you're filling out the customs form, on the bottom in bold letters in red ink, it says death to drug traffickers.
Yeah.
Death to drug traffickers. I mean, that's pretty bold.
Yeah.
That's pretty scary.
Yeah, and the Philippines did, in fact, execute a few drug traffickers last year. In some cases, foreign nationals, you know, Australian citizens who came into the Philippines, allegedly trafficking drugs and were executed for it.
Wow.
In China, it includes a wide range of crimes that we don't even know the full extent of the crimes that people are sentenced to death for. But it can include corruption and a wide range of nonviolent crimes.
Hmm.
We've also seen in places like Saudi Arabia and Iran execution for vaguely defined crimes like blasphemy or other religious offenses that don't have a clear meaning and can be prosecuted in any number of subjective ways.
And do they still do things like stone people to death?
In 2016, Amnesty International did not document any confirmed stonings. We have in years past. So it's not a completely eradicated practice, but there were no stonings documented last year.
Okay, I'd like to switch back to the U.S. for a second, because although we apparently executed as a country 20 people this past year, how many people got sentenced to death in that time?
So the number of death sentences in 2016 was 32, which is actually down quite a bit. Last year, or the year before, in 2015, we had 52 death sentences.
Wow. And were those also kind of led by Georgia and Texas?
Actually, no. So there were 32 death sentences between 13 states. The largest number was in California, where we had 9 death sentences. Following California, there were 4 death sentences in Florida, Ohio, and Texas. And so everybody else is in the 1 to 4 category, and California's at 9.
It's interesting because at the same time as California seems to be making strides in terms of not executing people, they're still putting people on death row.
California is a very interesting case. So, like you say, we haven't had an execution in well over a decade. We have been sentencing people to death at a very consistent rate. So our death row is the largest of any state by far. As far as making strides towards not executing, we saw a little bit of a change on the ballot last November. And voters in California, they narrowly rejected Prop 62, which would have abolished the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And they voted in Prop 66, which attempts to get executions going again. So currently Prop 66 is wrapped up in litigation, but if that litigation gets resolved, it's possible California could start scheduling executions this year.
Wow. That's bothersome.
Prop 66 is actually a really crazy proposition.
Tell us about it.
Well, one of the reasons that California executions have been on hold for so long, I mentioned earlier that we have a good system in place for qualifying defense attorneys. And so you have to be a qualified defense attorney, and we have a shortage of them in California. So Prop 66 lowers the qualifications. It makes it so that anybody is eligible to defend a murder trial. And it also changes around the appeals process to try to make it faster. But it doesn't explain how it's supposed to do that. It simply requires the Supreme Court to hire a bunch of new lawyers and get these appeals going. And then it puts a very arbitrary 5-year limit on the appeals process. I mean, I mentioned earlier, right now the appeals process takes about 25 years. So Prop 66 says cut it down to 5, but it doesn't say how or how that's supposed to be implemented or work.
Wow. So for one of the most progressive states in the union, that seems a little backwards, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. the death penalty has been an interesting issue in California. You know, we are certainly one of the most progressive states in the union. We've also got a really diverse population here in California. I wouldn't say necessarily that the progressive centers in our big urban areas are representative of the entire state population.
But, I mean, pretty much, doesn't the entire state, except for one county, vote Democratic?
The Democratic Party is not always an anti-death penalty party. The California Democratic Party added death penalty abolition to their platform not too long ago, maybe in 2011 or 2012, I think. But there is a long history of death penalty politics in California that gets pretty sordid. Mm-hmm. Do you remember Rose Byrd? Yeah. Right. You know, we had a Supreme Court Chief Justice and several other justices who were ousted, at least nominally, because of their opposition to the death penalty. And there's been a really strong backlash. That was in the 80s, like 84, I think. And there's been a strong backlash against death penalty politics ever since. But I do think that we took a big step in 2011 when we elected Kamala Harris as our attorney general. She's now our state senator. She's now our senator. And we elected Jerry Brown. And in that election, we elected a lot of anti-death penalty officials to our state offices. That we also in 2012 came very close to a death penalty abolition bill on Prop 34. Which is why we came back in 2016 and tried again. So we've seen, you know, the support for the death penalty in California used to be measured in the 80s. I mean, 80% of Californians used to support the death penalty not too long ago. And so I think even seeing these very narrow defeats for the death penalty abolition bills shows that Californians have come a really long way in understanding that the death penalty doesn't work.
So do you think that the reason why so many people in California supported it before was because there were some very heinous, notorious cases out here that people responded to with a strong desire for retribution?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's part of it. I think that goes into it. You know, there's just so many different factors. It's hard to say or to point to any one thing, but certainly there have been a lot of heinous cases that generate really spectacular media attention in California. You know, Charles Manson continues to be a talking point that people bring up when talking about the death penalty. Of course, he was sentenced to death, and then the death penalty was invalidated, and he was resentenced to life without or life with parole. Because at the time, life without parole didn't exist in California. So the maximum sentence he was given was life with the possibility of parole. And then, of course, he comes up for parole hearings every few years, and he makes news again in California. And I think California voters see that. They remember the last time Charles Manson had a parole hearing, and that comes to their minds when they think of the death penalty.
Well, I think he is pretty much ensuring himself that he's not going to be paroled.
Right.
But I guess it could happen.
You know, he that case, I think, brings up a really interesting point in the sort of psychology of support for the death penalty, and that's that. And you'll understand this as someone who obviously talks about crime and violence a great deal. When you have that conversation, as soon as you start talking about the death penalty, you're putting people into a position of fear. And they're thinking about violence, and they're thinking about horrible, horrible crimes and generating horrible images in their mind. And when you're in that position of fear, you know, that overwhelms how you might rationally evaluate things like sentencing and criminology. And so I think that Charles Manson coming to mind, you know, changes the way that people think about the death penalty.
Well, so, James, what do you hope for with this new report, this global report on executions that Amnesty has just put out?
Well, you know, at Amnesty, we oppose the death penalty because it violates human rights. So our goal is to shine a spotlight on human rights violations all over the world so that everyone can see really that the majority of the world is working hard to end this practice. And we're moving beyond it. We're working to protect human rights for everyone. But we need to pay attention to those countries and those states that are not following that trend, that are maybe moving in the opposite direction. And really, you know, focus our attentions on trying to change that trend and trying to bring them in line with the overall trend and the global trend, which is away from the death penalty.
Okay. And how can our listeners, if they're so inclined, how can they help out? How can they help out with the death penalty, and how could they help out with Amnesty in general?
That's a great question. So jump on our website, amnesty.org for Amnesty International and amnestyusa.org here in the United States. And get involved. You know, we've got action alerts on the death penalty. There's actually a really important death penalty situation happening in Arkansas that I can talk a little bit about. And we've got an online action for you to contact the governor of Arkansas to stop an assembly line of seven executions that are about to happen.
Tell us about it.
Sure. So just a few weeks ago, the governor of Arkansas scheduled 8 executions within a 10-day period. They're supposed to start next week on Monday, April 17th, the day after Easter Sunday. And they've got 2 executions scheduled each day on 4 separate days. And the reason for that is that their drug for the lethal injection is about to expire. So they have exactly 8 doses of midazolam, and they need to use all 8 before the end of April. They haven't executed anyone in 12 years, but all of a sudden they need to get rid of this drug. So they're going to basically hold an assembly line and execute all of these guys.
Well, this seems like exactly what I was talking about before. I mean, how can a government rationally do that, knowing that it's just because they have an inventory that they need to kill people to use?
I have no answer to that question.
Wow. I mean, I'm certainly willing to understand somebody's opposing view on that, but I really don't get it. I don't see how that is a justification for not killing anybody for over a decade and then just...
Well, and it shows how arbitrary the process is, right? All of these, I mean, we've talked about different arbitrary factors like race and wealth and abuse and intellectual ability. And now we're talking about an expiration date on a chemical on a shelf. And that's what's going to decide whether people live or die.
Yeah.
So they scheduled 8. The courts have intervened in one of those cases. The clemency board recommended clemency in one of those cases. And so the court delayed that execution. 7 of them are still planned to be carried out within the next couple of weeks. Amnesty and the ACLU and a number of organizations have really been campaigning hard to urge Governor Asa Hutchinson to stop these executions right away. So you can jump on our website and you'll find an action alert to send a letter to Governor Hutchinson, and we'll be delivering that petition on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, you should at least, I'm just really putting it out there for our listeners, at least consider what that means about the United States and our stand in the world. That kind of justice seems like it will be not played very well overseas. And we really lose our standing as a moral country if we're actually killing people just because there's an expiration date on the stuff we use to kill them. I mean, that's really crazy.
It's shocking.
Yeah. Well, James, is there anything else that you want to talk to our listeners about?
You know, there was actually one other piece of the international picture that I didn't get to that I think is really interesting to just kind of talk about for a minute.
Sure.
And that's Vietnam. Mm-hmm. We discovered through some media reports that came out earlier this year that Vietnam has had a secret execution spree over the last 3 years that no one knew about, over 400 executions.
Wow.
And it actually placed Vietnam in the top three as the third biggest executor for 2013 up through 2016. And we don't know which executions happened in which year, so we can't kind of parse it out year to year. But we know that we suddenly learned that Vietnam has been up there.
On average, they killed more than all but two other countries.
Right, right, just following China and Iran.
Wow. And how did you find out about this?
They came out in media reports in Vietnam in February of 2017.
Really?
Yeah.
And what was their justification for this program? Does anybody know?
I mean, they continue to maintain that the death penalty is a state secret. And so, you know, the basis for the executions is still under lock and key.
And what about North Korea? Are they in that mix?
I do believe that North Korea is one of the larger executors. The countries, as far as secrecy, the countries that I know that keep their death penalty data the most secret are, of course, China, and then also Vietnam and Malaysia. And the other thing about secrecy is that a lot of governments will selectively reveal data for when it serves their purposes. So certainly North Korea has had some high-profile executions of former government officials, and, you know, they use that for propaganda purposes.
Right.
But the true extent of their death penalty, I think, is something that we don't know.
Got it. All right. Well, I really appreciate you coming out, James, and talking to us about Amnesty International's work in the area of executions and the death penalty. So hopefully that we and our listeners can help move that needle forward towards a more just way to deal with violent criminals. It's not that we don't think that they should be dealt with. It's just, I don't know that always fighting violence with violence is a good thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you very much. I really appreciate being here.
All right, take care.
Thank you. You too.